the Gaza Strip, the death toll of Palestinians nears 30,000, most of them women and children. The Hamas resistance movement says the US is complicit in the Israeli genocide against the Palestinian people. And Yemenis hold yet another weekly rally in solidarity with Palestinians facing the Israeli aggression on Gaza. Thank you for joining us. Now, Israeli occupation forces have conducted fresh strikes on the Gaza Strip, killing dozens of Palestinians and leaving hundreds of others injured. At least 24 people, mostly women and children, were killed in an Israeli airstrike in the city of Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. Israeli warships also opened fire off the coast of Rafah, the southern border city where some 1.5 million Palestinians have taken shelter. Elsewhere in the south, the regime's warplanes carried out an airstrike targeting the western areas of the cities of Khan Yunis. In the same city, Israeli troops once again stormed the Nasser Medical Complex, preventing the entry or exit of medical personnel and civilians. More than 29,500 Palestinians, most of them women and children, have been killed since the Israeli onslaught against Gaza started on October the 7th. About 70,000 others have also been injured. Israeli forces have launched new airstrikes against the southern Gaza city of Rafah. The city, housing nearly 1.5 million people from across the besieged strip, had been declared a safe zone by the regime. Let's listen to some Palestinians describing their plight after the latest strike.
Every day, there are 50 martyrs in the safe areas, or 100 martyrs. Every day, 20 to 30 houses or 30 buildings are destroyed. This is an international conspiracy against us. This is what they want. Every day there are 30, 50 or 100 killed, numbers like that. Why then would they want a ceasefire? We are dying little by little. We have more than 100,000 martyrs and wounded. Even if the Israelis leave us, more than 200,000 or 300,000 people will die from the exposure to gases and toxic fumes from the bombardments. This is how we will die. Those American weapons that are donated to Israel, we have never seen anything like this. Israeli rockets are targeting children, homes, and places housing innocent, simple civilians.
There is no safe place in Gaza. They said Rafah was a safe place. Look and show people how safe it is. They dropped barrels of bombs on innocent people in their sleep. They were innocent children. They were left under the rubble last night.
We were sleeping in our house when we heard the sound of a missile. The noise was very loud, and as you can see, it caused a significant amount of damage. We rushed to the site and found people martyred and injured. This is humiliating. As you can see, this two-story house was completely erased. This was an annihilation missile, not a normal missile. Rafah is supposed to be safe, but as you can see, nowhere is left safe. The places they said were safe are targeted with missiles. There's no safety.
The head of the international charity group Doctors Without Borders has denounced the United States for vetoing UN Security Council resolutions on a ceasefire in Gaza. Christopher Lockyer has also criticized the Security Council for its failure to address the crisis in Gaza. He was speaking at a Security Council meeting on Thursday.
We are appalled by the willingness of the United States to use its powers as a permanent council member to obstruct efforts to adopt the most evident of resolutions, one demanding an immediate and sustained ceasefire. Three times this council has had an opportunity to vote for the ceasefire that is so desperately needed, and three times the United States has used its veto power, most recently this Tuesday. We, along with the world, are closely watching how this council and its members have approached the conflict in Gaza. Meeting after meeting, resolution after resolution, this body has failed to effectively address this conflict. We have watched members of this council deliberate and delay while civilians die. A new draft resolution by the United States ostensibly calls for a ceasefire However, this is misleading at best. This council should reject any resolution that further hampers humanitarian efforts on the ground and leads this council to tacitly endorse the continued violence and mass atrocities in Gaza. There are not enough hospital beds, there are not enough medications, and not enough supplies. Surgeons have had no choice but to carry out amputations without anesthesia on children. Our surgeons are running out of basic gauze to stop their patients from bleeding. They use it once, squeeze out the blood, wash it, sterilize it, and reuse it for the next patient. The people of Gaza need a ceasefire, not when practicable, but now. They need a sustained ceasefire, not a temporary period of calm. Anything short of this is gross negligence.
A senior Hamas official says Israel cannot continue its genocidal war in Gaza without the support of its main ally, the United States.
America playing a role, being a complete accomplice in the genocidal war being waged by the Zionist entity or by the occupation entity against the unarmed civilians in the Gaza Strip, and the also full-fledged support for all of the massacres and the crimes which constitute a violation of international laws because of the administration obstructing any attempts to put an end to the aggression. And this means an American green light, a clear green light for the Zionist enemy to continue with its crimes. And here, we stress that the hunger war being waged and the ongoing massacres and the systematic destruction of all forms of life in the Gaza Strip would not have continued were it not for the support of this criminal administration whose hands are soaked in the blood of our people, the men or the women, children and elderly. And full responsibility falls on the shoulders of the occupation. This would not have happened were it not for the direct role of the American administration as a result of the war machine, which is completely funded by it, and also being a direct accomplice on the ground.
Speaking at a press conference in Beirut, Hamdan also called for an independent investigation into a recent UN report revealing multiple forms of abuse by Israeli forces against Palestinian women and children in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. The senior Hamas official added that Israel will never achieve its goal of releasing the captives in Gaza through the use of force. He also denounced the regime's, quote, war of famine against Palestinians in Gaza, and called on international organizations, including the World Food Programme and the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, or UNRWA, not to give in to Israeli pressure. Hamdan also warned that any Israeli assault on the Al-Aqsa Mosque or Palestinian worshippers in the occupied Al-Quds will not go unpunished. Palestinian resistance movements continue to push back against Israeli forces in Gaza as fighting on the ground continues. The military wing of the Hamas resistance movement says it has targeted a group of Israeli forces with anti-personnel missiles inside a building in Gaza City. The Qassam Brigade says it also struck an Israeli Merkava tank with missiles. Meanwhile, intense fighting continues in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza Strip, where the Islamic Jihad says it launched a deadly attack on a gathering place of Israeli troops. Israel has confirmed the deaths of more than 230 of its troopers since the regime began the Gaza onslaught. Palestinians, however, say Israel is hiding the actual number in an attempt at damage control amid the failed Gaza onslaught. The Hezbollah resistance movement says it has targeted several Israeli military sites across the Lebanese border. The group says it hit Israeli sites in the occupied Sheba farms with missiles. According to Hezbollah, the attacks left injuries amongst Israeli troopers. The movement says it also launched drone strikes on several other Israeli locations near the Lebanese border. The resistance movement and the Israeli military have been exchanging fire since the regime began its onslaught on the Gaza Strip on October 7th. Hezbollah has vowed to support Palestinian resistance fighters battling Israel's Gaza onslaught by engaging the regime's forces on another front. The top UN court is holding the fifth day of public hearings on Israel's decades-long occupation of Palestinian territories. The oral proceedings are related to a case brought by the UN General Assembly following a resolution passed in December 2022. Representatives from a number of countries have addressed the ongoing session of the International Court of Justice. Let's listen to some of those speeches.
Occupation acts primarily on the basis of usurping land by force, which is essentially prohibited under international law and the provisions of the Charter. It also acts on the basis of suppressing the will of the people, seeking to degrade their dignity and deprive them of their basic rights. Today, the practices of Israel, the occupying power, are definitely the clearest reflection, unfortunately, of the failure of the international community to prevent heinous crime of occupation and to ensure the implementation of the relevant resolutions of Security Council, General Assembly, and the Human Rights Council. The Syrian Arab Republic stresses the need to hold Israel accountable for its grave and continuing violations of the provisions of international law, the Charter of the United Nations and its relevant resolutions, and the provisions of international humanitarian law, including provisions in Section 3 of the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949, Article 47, and what follows.
Mr. President, distinguished members of the Court, I have the honour to appear before you on behalf of the Government of Norway in the present proceedings. Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory has continued since 1967. Recent developments give rise to the utmost concern. They include ongoing, indiscriminate and disproportionate use of force and other measures in the Gaza Strip, as well as illegal settlements in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. House evictions, demolitions, forced displacement and settler violence against the Palestinian population are aspects of the Israeli occupation. Such acts run counter to fundamental human rights, international humanitarian law, and the right to self-determination of the Palestinian people. Mr. President, the Israeli settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem constitute a chief obstacle to any prospect of settlement and peace in the area.
Under the title, Our Path with Gaza Moves Forward Until Victory, thousands of Yemenis have taken to the streets of Sana'a and other cities to reaffirm their full support for the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports from Sana'a.
In yet another rally to support the Palestinians in Gaza Strip, thousands of Yemenis have filled the streets of the capital Sana'a and other major cities. They chanted slogans supporting Palestinian resistance and condemned the Arab world's indifference toward Israeli atrocities in Gaza.
The Yemeni people were raised since their childhood to love and adore Palestine and to love jihad in Palestine. Therefore, when the opportunity arose to have an influential position under the leadership of Ansarullah, they did not hesitate and went out to the streets, believing that their protests were jihad for the sake of God, as the least duty as long as the borders were not open for them, and they were not able to fight with the Palestinians.
A message to the European peoples. Your governments today are contributing to genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza by submitting to America's orders to militarize the Red Sea. America involves you in its own problems. The solution to stopping the Red Sea operations is to stop the aggression against Gaza and lift the siege. This is the easiest solution. But if your government wants to submit to America's orders, you will see what we will teach. I mean, you will see that we will teach America a lesson that will never forget. And if you attack us, you will unfortunately meet the same fate.
Protesters praised the recent operations by the Yemeni army, including the sinking of a British vessel in the Gulf of Aden. They also celebrated the introduction of the submarine weapon into the Yemeni army's arsenal, believing it will enhance the success of Yemen's naval operations.
The submarines introduced by Abdul Malik al-Houthi are one of the surprises that the enemy is going to face if it continues its aggression against Gaza. The Yemeni armed forces, specifically the Yemeni Navy, still have surprises coming, a wide range of targets, and also a superior ability to obtain information at any time and place. Therefore, these are successive military messages, the content of which is that we will escalate further as long as Israel's war in Gaza continues, and Yemen has the upper hand in its waters, and this position will never change.
Earlier, the spokesman of the Yemeni army announced that they have successfully carried out three military operations. The first operation involved launching multiple ballistic missiles and drones against various targets in Eilat-occupied Palestine. The other two attacks targeted an American destroyer and the British vessel Islander in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden. He added that the British ship was set on fire as a result of the attack.
Every Friday, people gather here affirming that they will never tire of taking to the streets to show support for the oppressed people of Palestine as long as the Israeli genocide war on Gaza continues. They believe it is the least that all Muslims around the world should do as a religious duty toward the innocent civilians of Palestine. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
And with that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The British government has quietly signed a contract targeting 20% cuts to the number of new education plans for children with special educational needs. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Hundreds of children with special educational needs have been waiting for a year or longer to access support, as local authorities across England buckle under the strain of demands placed on them. Freedom of Information requests found that in some local authorities, children and young people have been waiting more than 2 years to be issued with an education, health and care plan that details the support they require. The Freedom of Information results suggest that across England, more than 20,000 cases were waiting longer than the 20-week limit, and as many as 3,000 for a year or more. Local council leaders say that requests for education, health and care plans have surged in recent years while funding to meet the children's needs has not kept pace. Since 2019, the number of plans issued has risen by 72%, so that in 2023, more than 500,000 children and young people had education, health and care plans. But dedicated funding from central government for special education needs and disabilities has only risen by 42%. Alex Dale, the Cabinet Member for Education at Derbyshire County Council, said, "It's clearly a massive issue and no local authority wants to be in a position where it is going over the statutory time frame or making families wait any longer than they should." Alex Dale, who also chairs the F40 group of local authorities campaigning for fairer education funding, said one of the main reasons behind the delays was the sheer increase in demand. He said, "In my local authority, we've calculated that the number of education, health and care plans we have on our books, if you like, has doubled in the past 7 years, and that's pretty much replicated across the country." Derbyshire is investing a further £1 million to improve its processing of education, health and care plans. But Alex Dale says that £1 million has got to come from the council's own resources, which are very much under pressure anyway. And there's a huge competing demands. It's a real challenge. No one wants to be in a position that we're in at the moment. But I think it's an inevitable consequence of that rise in demand. Even after education, health and care plans have been issued, parents who spoke to the Guardian newspaper described a nightmarish system of appeals and tribunals to obtain support, including a case in York of identical twins whose parents were offered only one place in a special school. Sean Levin, the chief executive of the Twins Trust charity, said, "Unfortunately, this case is common and similar to others that we've seen. Families with multiples already face significant economic, social and health disadvantage. Issues with school admissions just cause extra stress and extra anxiety for both the parents and the children." Another case involving twins in Guildford, Surrey, highlights the difficulties that parents are facing. David and Louise May have twin sons, one without special needs who is in a mainstream secondary school preparing to take his GCSEs. But his twin brother Jack, diagnosed with autism and ADHD, has been out of full-time education since summer of 2022, despite having an education, health and care plan through Surrey Council. Jack was placed in a mainstream school in year 7, but his struggles made it unsustainable. An initial rejection of a special school place was overturned after Jack's parents appealed. This was followed by the offer of a special school place for children with severe disabilities that was unsuitable. Jack's parents then found him a place at a private school, which the school abruptly ended after the COVID crisis, saying it could not meet his needs. Now they're waiting for the local authority to redraw Jack's education, health and care plan, and are hoping that a place in an appropriate school can be found while Jack receives 12 hours a week of home tuition funded by the local council. The couple have had a continuing struggle with Surrey Council over Jack's education, with David May describing months and months passing without getting responses from the administration. He said, "The problem is, in my opinion, that staff are overworked, underpaid, stressed out, and they can't get enough places. And so there's a massive turnover of staff. How can they place children without enough places?" Munira Wilson, the Liberal Democrat spokesperson on education who raised Jack's case during a parliamentary debate on special needs funding, recently said, "Imagine how devastating it is for parents to see one child thrive while its twin suffers." A spokesperson for the Department of Education claimed the government was committed to improving support. The spokesperson said, "High needs funding for children and young people with complex needs will be increasing to a total of over £10.5 billion in 2024-2025. An increase of over 60% since 2019-2020. The website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. The British government has quietly signed a contract targeting 20% cuts to the number of new education plans for children with special educational needs and disabilities to bring down costs. Then Junior Education Minister Claire Coutinho, recently promoted to the Cabinet as Energy Secretary, subsequently told MPs that no targets were in place. The cuts target has emerged as councils across England grapple with huge financial deficits on SEND budgets, caused by a combination of rising demand and long-standing underfunding. Part of the government's response has been the launch of the Delivering Better Value in SEND programme, which supports 55 councils to bring down their large SEND budget deficits through measures such as early intervention and teaching children with special needs in mainstream schools. In June of 2022, the Department for Education signed a £19.5 million contract with consultancy firm Newton Europe to design and develop the Delivering Better Value in SEND programme. The deliverable section of the contract states that it is the intention of the signatories that the 55 councils' budget management plans implemented under the DBV programme will help achieve impacts including reduced cost pressure as a result of reduced growth in the number of education, health and care plans, targeting at least a 20% reduction in new education, health and care plans issued. The contract states that the impacts will be measured by monitoring education, health, care plans, growth rates and the state of councils' education budgets.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and let us ponder on a short but sweet saying from our expected saviour of mankind, Imam Mahdi, may the Lord hasten his reappearance, concerning right and truth on the threshold of his birth anniversary. Indeed, right is with us and in us, and nobody else would claim that but a liar and an impostor.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how to attain ultimate perfection. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is such an honor to be here at your service, dear brothers and sisters. We're talking about how to attain ultimate perfection. Now, of course, this is a subject which takes, you know, a lot of time and a lot of research, and it can't simply be answered in a very short time frame, but, you know, why not try? How to attain ultimate perfection? If we were to bring it down, you know, to its very basic fundamentals, of course, keeping in mind that this is something that, you know, hours and hours and perhaps a whole lifetime can be spent on trying to understand this idea of how do you attain ultimate perfection and the ups and downs that are on this path. But it comes down to really two things. One is to do those things which are wajib upon us, they are obligatory upon us, and the other is to refrain from those things which are haram upon us, those things which have been prohibited to us and prohibited from us, we shouldn't be doing, is what we're trying to say. So if you do that which Allah wants you to do, and you don't do that which Allah doesn't want you to do, then you will attain ultimate perfection. Now, we have to be, you know, very careful in the idea that this is a very fundamental and it's a basic, and the stronger this basic becomes, you know, the closer we become to ultimate perfection. Now, we do have to keep in mind, though, that along this road of trying to attain ultimate perfection, in our Islamic lifestyle, of course, we're going to run into obstacles and hardships and trials. And it is at that point and time when we face those hardships and those trials and those difficulties that we have to be able to persevere, be strong, be steadfast, and pass those trials. And as we continue to pass trials and we continue to succeed in the different tests that come about in our life as we try to attain ultimate perfection, we will continue to become closer to attaining perfection, especially when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about how to attain ultimate perfection. Of course, in the last segment, we did make it very clear that this is not necessarily something that can, you know, be easily solved, you know, in such a short amount of time on our program. Of course, we said that, you know, this can take a whole lifetime to really fully understand in its depth and its profundity and how complex and beautiful it is. But at the same time, we said that just as Islam is a simple religion which has come to make life easy, even this ultimate success and this ultimate perfection, the fundamental, you know, key aspect to it is also quite simple, and that is that, you know, we should do what Allah wants us to do and has commanded us to do, and we don't do what Allah has commanded us to not do. And yes, it does seem simple, but the closer we go towards attaining perfection, you know, we will find that there will be times where trials and difficulties will come into play, you know, and will prevent us in one way or the other from not committing sins, and it will prevent us from committing good things. So on both sides, somehow, some trial, some difficulty, some problem, some situation will come up in which we will, it'll be an obstacle or a hurdle for us in trying to do what we're supposed to do, or on the other hand, in trying to not do what we're not supposed to do. So, you know, it'll become incredibly easy to commit a sin, or it'll become incredibly hard to do that thing which is obligatory upon us. And it is in those specific places in our life that we have to be very careful. We have to beg Allah, the Almighty, for help so that we can pass those trials and those tests, and really, in the end, so that we can achieve that beautiful, that pure, and that blessed, and that honorable Islamic lifestyle that we are all searching for.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Midstream.
Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah emphasized on Friday, February 15, that the price of civilian blood in Lebanon will be blood in Zionist Israel in the wake of the Israeli occupation's killing of 10 Lebanese civilians, including 7 from the same family, in an airstrike deep in Lebanese territory earlier last week. Sayyid Nasrallah publicly stated that the aggression that occurred in the cities of Nabatieh and Salwaneh in South Lebanon was a development that must be stopped. He then added, targeting civilians and the martyrdom of a large number of them is deliberate, emphasizing that the enemy could have avoided killing civilians in southern Lebanon and will pay blood for shedding the blood of our women and children. Sayyid Nasrallah then stressed that this front will not stop no matter how much Zionist Israel attacks, kills, and threatens, emphasizing that the response to the Nabatieh massacre must be to continue working on the front and escalating. In the aftermath of the speech, the Islamic resistance in Lebanon carried out several attacks against Israeli occupation military sites along the border with occupied Palestine, targeting the Doviv barracks, the Ramya site, the Zibdin and Ruwaisat al-Alam sites in the occupied Sheba farms, and the Israeli entity site of al-Malikiyeh. These attacks came in conjunction with statements by Sayyid Nasrallah, who said, "The resistance does not accept harming civilians and that the enemy must understand that it has gone too far in this matter." The Hebrew channel Khan reported after the speech that the Israeli entity authorities have closed several roads in the north following threats from Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. As a result, former Israeli Mossad Chief Danny Yatom affirmed that it is not in Zionist Israel's interest to initiate opening a war front with Hezbollah in South Lebanon. It is worth noting that the Israeli entity military sources previously confirmed that the Israeli occupation army, built up in recent years, does not have the capacity to intensively fight on two fronts, in the Gaza Strip and Lebanon. Earlier, the Zionist Israeli newspaper Haaretz confirmed that Hezbollah has succeeded in imposing a kind of security belt in northern occupied Palestine, where settlements there have become deserted, and that it will remain that way as long as fighting continues in Gaza. This was ratified by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's declaration that our goal, all of us in the axis of resistance, has been and will remain to defeat the enemy in this battle and prevent it from achieving any of its objectives, and for Gaza to emerge victorious from this battle. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. After after the Israeli entity airstrikes that targeted several towns in southern Lebanon over the past 2 days, resulting in the martyrdom of 9 Lebanese civilians and the martyrdom of several resistance Hezbollah and ML movement fighters, Hezbollah threatened escalation on the border. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah said on Friday that the Israeli entity attacks on Nabatiye and Sawene in southern Lebanon constitute an escalation because they targeted civilians and killed a large number of them, hinting that the resistance might strike Eilat inside of occupied Palestine. To discuss this issue with us from Washington is Dr. Ziad Al-Hafiz, former head of the Arab National Conference, political writer and commentator. Thanks a million, Dr. Ziad. It's really early in the morning in Washington, so thank you for being with us. Now, initially, the Americans seemed basically adamant on trying to find some sort of a balance between the Zionist entity and Lebanon, but following the latest speech of Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, Zionist Israel has resorted again to the policy of victimhood and the policy of self-pity, which basically it masters usually to just attract more some sort of unconditional Western support every time it wants to wage a war. Setting Western support aside for this particular matter, is escalating the war with Lebanon currently an actual viable option for Zionist Israel?
The short answer to that is no. It's not a viable option. But the point is, nowadays, we are no longer seeing, neither in Israel nor in the United States or the collective West, per se, rational thinking and rational behavior. I think the State of Israel and its sponsors, the United States and the collective West, are more and more motivated by ideology and self-interest rather than by clear political objectives. Mm-hmm. In Gaza, despite the horrors that they have committed, they have not been able to achieve anything on the ground, the Israeli forces. And if Gaza, which is from a point of view of the battlefield, is a much easier quote-unquote target for the Israelis, it is a totally different discussion for the northern border, especially in Lebanon. So the escalation is not really a viable option. Mm-hmm. So the object of the escalation or the gradual escalation of hostilities in the north is to trigger this response from Hezbollah, eventually having a widening war, which the Americans did not want in the first place, in order to allow the Israeli forces to continue or to be able to pursue their objectives. They haven't so far been able except to generate a massacre of population, generated lots of hostility and in the West, even among the populations of the West, against the State of Israel and the policies of the government of the collective West.
But Dr. Hafiz, you say that they want to try and make Hezbollah the bad person here, or try to make Hezbollah initiate some sort of a provocation, but the resistance has declared, it has personally declared, that the number of operations that they carried out against the Israeli occupation forces since October 8th, during 131 days from October 8th till February 15, 2024, has reached 1,038 operations. This is in support of the resilient Palestinian people in Gaza, obviously, and in solidarity with their resistance, and in response to the Israeli entity attack on multiple Lebanese villages as well. Yet Zionist Israel remained deterred. They have been provoked by Hezbollah. They did not reply, as at least as how we Arabs have seen it before. And we did not see any form of U.S. direct involvement against Hezbollah for that matter. We did see it only in Yemen, for example. How come? What is the current U.S. strategy concerning Lebanon and the confrontation right here?
Because Hezbollah has been targeting military objectives, not civilian objectives. And therefore, a possible outcry of targeting civilian objectives has not taken place. So they can absorb the military losses, they can absorb or can even they hide them. So it does not really constitute a basic issue as long as the United States is able to provide the lifeline to the Israeli forces. But now, and this is a new development, and as stated by the General Secretary Hassan Nasrallah, saying that now blood will be responded by blood. And this is a new ball game. We have to see how the Israelis will react to the new attacks of Hezbollah where civilians will no longer be spared as they used to be spared until now in the South Sudan so operations that they have conducted. And if civilians had casualties have occurred, it is basically what you call collateral damage. But the resistance has been extremely careful in targeting military objectives that have a certain, a very clear effectiveness in reducing the capabilities of the Israeli forces. And so far, that was the logic or the strategy followed by the resistance in Lebanon. Now, with the targeting of civilians by the Israeli forces in order to attract response, it's going to provoke a similar reaction, not maybe not of the scale that the Israelis hope or want, but significant to deter them. And we have to see how the Israelis are going to respond to this new tit for tat approach by the Lebanese resistance, mm-hmm. and how also the Americans are going to respond to that. I don't think they have the capability to launch a full-scale war in Lebanon, and they have not succeeded in Gaza, so I do not see in terms of pure rational military thinking what can they achieve. If they want to start bombing civilians in Lebanon like they did in Gaza, mm-hmm. then obviously the response is going to be quite clear, the bombing of civilians, between quotation marks, because I don't think there are civilians in the state of Israel. It's going to be the same, and I don't think they can sustain that. So this is where we are at this stage.
Mm-hmm. Well, something rather weird goes on in Lebanon every time we have some sort of a confrontation between the resistance and the Zionist occupation is that we have Lebanese voices who are historically anti-resistance in Lebanon, who are from Lebanese political factions, who demand the disarmament of their own resistance and the adherence to certain international law that Zionist Israel has never adhered to. Do they not see that the current aggression is just similar to previous aggressions, is similar to upcoming aggressions, that it is deliberately targeting Lebanese civilians in the south? I mean, who do they suggest will protect us, will protect the civilians, especially in South Lebanon, if the resistance actually becomes disarmed?
Actually, that leadership that you're referring to are the same leadership who have caused the Lebanese civil war. And apparently, they have not learned the lessons from the Lebanese civil war, and they certainly have not been able to read the transformation or the changes that have been taking place in the world and in the region. It's a totally different world. They are still stuck in a pre-1975 mentality where their own privileges and superiority was really the stake. Now they are trying to get back to that situation, and they cannot. And the only way they can do it is by a total alignment with the collective West. And the collective West does not really have at heart the interest of Lebanon, but really the interest of Israel. They don't mind, as long as their own particular interests and privileges are being maintained or restored or even increased. And this is what is driving these factions in Lebanon, who are, in my opinion, a minority, not representing the majority, a small minority, but vocal, mm-hmm. with lots of financial power and backing, of course, from the collective West.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Ziad Hafiz, former head of the Arab National Conference and political writer and commentator, thank you very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure hearing your analysis concerning what's going on. Ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how Zionist Israel is preparing another catastrophe in Rafah.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Well, in full view of the world, Zionist Israel continues its aggression against the Gaza Strip, disregarding all international legal norms and decisions, foremost among them the prohibition of committing war crimes and genocide against civilians. Despite all the occupation's crimes in the Gaza Strip, including killing, starving, displacing, and destroying, and its pretext of safe zones in South Gaza, its criminal journey has now reached Rafah, which was previously not spared from its aggression during the war, but this time the threats of expanding its operations. More details in the following report.
It seems that the Middle East is preparing to become a battleground from which fires will erupt that will consume this world. 4 months into the genocide of the Palestinian people who are being collectively and indiscriminately killed, their landmarks of life and future destroyed, and their fate frozen under the guise of a trending massive propaganda campaign called Rafah. This campaign is being used today as a distraction and diversion, while the true currents are much greater than what we imagine. This Rafah campaign is brought to you under the sponsorship of the United States of America with the slogan, "Kill more, have fun more," and is sponsored by the morally, politically, and financially bankrupt European Union, which distributes free drinks in the tents of the displaced and praises the necessity of eating diet bread for Gaza, maybe made from ground fodder, barley, and contaminated water. The unprecedented violence, bloodthirsty extremism, and unyielding determination evident in the enemy's plan only conceal fragility and stand on a foundation of severe failure and immense losses, which justify its blind and visionless actions of killing innocents and seeking revenge against them. Options are crowded around the fate of the battle in Rafah, depending on a wide range of factors and influences surrounding this anticipated operation specifically, or other factors encompassing the entirety of the confrontation in Gaza, organically linked to other confrontations in Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen, which constitute the main support fronts for the resistance in Gaza. Here, considerations related to the actual reasons for this anticipated Israeli entity operation in Rafah also crowd in. While some see it as a maneuver to pressure Palestinian resistance no more, aiming to push them to compromise on the issue of a prisoner exchange deal, others perceive it as a complex maneuver, combining a military operation against leaders, cadres, and fighters of Palestinian resistance factions in that border area with Egypt, with a search and rescue operation for Israeli entity prisoners held by Palestinian resistance and an attempt to liberate them, and with a process of regularization and pushing the largest number of Palestinian refugees who have fled to Rafah or its essential residents towards Sinai to escape from killing, destruction, and massacres, which will inevitably occur with the aim of imposing and achieving this refuge to Egypt. This is what Zionist Israel wants. Practically, it seems that the Israeli regime's political and military decision to launch a wide-scale aggression on the Rafah governorate has been effectively completed. While initially the Americans appeared to disapprove of the operation, citing its danger to the massive civilian population gathered in Rafah, some hints have emerged today suggesting a change in their public stance towards approval with the condition of laying out a clear plan. They insist on receiving details in advance and taking into account the safety of civilians, as they claim, while openly providing the weapons needed to exterminate those same civilians, encompassing a recipe for a regional and possibly global disaster.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ali Murad, journalist at Al-Akhbar Daily and political writer and commentator. Thanks a million, Mr. Ali, for being with us. Now, initially, we did see that the United States of America seemed to oppose maybe any operation against Rafah, expressing concern about the potential danger it poses to its sizable civilian population, especially in Rafah. However, recent indications suggest that there is a shift in the public approval of the United States of America, especially the Biden administration, concerning an operation that could be carried out in Rafah. But has the Israeli occupation forces received a green light from the American administration to widely spread the aggression across all of Rafah? And if so, what will be the aftermath of such a senseless decision?
Of course, there has been clear American approval from the beginning of this operation, but there has been an attempt, hypocritically, by the American administration over the past 2 or 3 days in their statements, where they said they reject this operation because there are approximately 1,400,000 displaced Palestinians in the Rafah area. This is required for the American administration because we must not forget that when Biden announced this rejection or reservation on the military operation in Rafah, some officials from his administration were meeting with Arab community leaders in Michigan and needed to persuade them to change their stance on the eve of the primary elections, happening on the 27th of this February. In addition to pressure from global public opinion, were two factors pushing the American administration to continue the policy of hypocrisy, pretending to care about civilians, while at the same time still sending thousands of tons of ammunition and smart bombs. You can read about this in one of the American newspapers, where there was a page in the Wall Street Journal the day before yesterday, where the first headline was about the American administration's reservation about the Israeli entity operation in Rafah due to their concern for civilian lives. But boldly, the next headline was about Biden's administration approving sending more ammunition and missiles to Zionist Israel. Therefore, this hypocrisy can be observed clearly in this war, where they falsely claim to care about civilians, while the result is more than 30,000 martyrs and around 65,000 wounded so far, and they are not satisfied with that. Rather, they consider that they want to reach the final point in invading the Gaza Strip, which is Rafah. Thus, the American and the Israeli entity calculations align in this context, and the result will be an answer to your question. More martyrs, more massacres, more extermination, and a chance for Netanyahu and all the extreme right-wing ruling with him in the war cabinet attempting to expel Palestinians from the Gaza Strip to Egypt, and trying to corner Egypt in receiving a large portion of the displaced Palestinians for humanitarian reasons.
This is what I want to discuss with you, because observing the Egyptian official stance concerning the possible operation on Rafah, we see that it opposes this operation just to prevent one of its potential outcomes, which is the displacement of a large portion of the Gaza Palestinians into the Sinai desert, not to protect them, just to not allow them to come, which is why we're seeing it building even a higher wall between Rafah and Egypt. But this also means that Egypt can have a leverage when dealing with the Zionist entity concerning any future upcoming operation in Rafah. Will the Egyptian authority be allowed to use that leverage, if possible, by the Biden administration? And if so, how will that affect the Palestinians that are currently trying to survive in Rafah?
First, we must note that since the beginning of the aggression on Gaza, the Egyptian stance has been weak. This means they are forced to seek permission from Netanyahu's government to allow aid into the Gaza Strip. I'm talking here about a dozen trucks per day. We must not forget that until the 21st of October, the first aid truck entered the Gaza Strip after the Americans obtained permission from the Israeli entity to allow the Egyptians to bring in aid. This means that Egypt chose from the beginning not to use its leverage. It has many strong cards, as it is the largest Arab state that possesses the strongest Arab army in terms of armament and equipment, and thus the borders between the Gaza Strip and Egyptian territories in Sinai are a matter of sovereignty between Palestinians and Egyptians. However, the Egyptian regime chose not to use these power cards, and in my opinion, this is what makes the Israeli entity war government strive to achieve its goal of collectively expelling Palestinians to Egypt. And I believe that at a certain stage when this battle begins in Rafah, thousands and tens of thousands of Palestinians will head to the fence. And I believe the Egyptians at that time will find themselves in an awkward position before the global public opinion. And this is what Netanyahu aspires to. The Egyptian regime will eventually have to receive some of these Palestinians. We must not forget that about 2 or 3 months ago, photos and videos of tents being prepared in northern Sinai were leaked. These tents, in my opinion, may have been prepared to accommodate Palestinians, meaning that Egypt will surrender and comply with the reality imposed by Netanyahu and his war government on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the actual and primary criteria for the Israeli enemy's reluctance to engage or to proceed with the proposed operation against Rafah remains its fear of the danger of confrontation with the resistance in this very strategic area. It's not Egypt, it's not anyone else. It is, in fact, the resistance. The resistance regards Rafah as its only opportunity